What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go paper-tarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to Car Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm your host, Scott Benjamin, and today we have got a what I think is a fascinating list that we're going to kind of follow through. We've done this in the past on Car Stuff before, and, you know, of course, with two people, it's a little easier to, you know, go back and forth with these, but I feel like this is a pretty good one, and I want you to understand that this isn't kind of the end-all of lists, of course, and this is somebody's opinion, and there's a lot of these out there. You can find these all over the place, but the list that I'm going to be reading today is the 17 best bad cars ever built. Now, that's a strange way to say it, I understand. So what we're talking about is essentially kind of like the best of the worst, the top of the bottom, if you will. That's if you want to kind of flip it around that way and say it that way. You know, the thing is, like, a lot of these cars are going to strike some kind of opinion within you, and you might say, well, I had one of these and I absolutely loved it, or yeah, I had one and I agree with you that it was terrible, or I've heard of these cars before and they're just a miserable mess. But hopefully it's a decent list and you guys will appreciate it. And what I want really is for you to kind of write in and chime in with some of your own best of the worst, if you will, because I know that there's a lot that don't make this list. Clearly, that, you know, they're lists of, you know, 100 cars that people have kind of grown to hate over the years, and some people do agree, some people don't agree with those. But, you know, one thing that I want to mention here, and it's something that I had read about this week while I was reading this article and many others like it. I found that a lot of cars that in the past had been praised by automotive journalists were then later deemed to be kind of bad cars. And it happens. It doesn't happen all the time, but what happens is, you know, the manufacturer gets all excited about a brand new product that's coming out, and they bring journalists to their property, or, you know, they take them on to some ride and drive event somewhere, and they bring out series of these cars, you know, a selection of these cars for the journalists to drive and allow them to kind of, you know, run through their paces either for a day on their property or take them out somewhere or whatever. And the funny thing about this is they will give the journalists like the absolute best version of that car. You know, it has the highest trim level. It has all the options. There are people on hand to make sure that everything is running smoothly and all the software is working right. You know, the everything is exactly the way it should be in that vehicle. So these are what a lot of journalists would call like ringer cars. You know, they're the ones that are brought out, you know, specifically for this purpose to impress the automotive press so that they can, you know, then write about them favorably and maybe even, you know, get them in early on some awards. And that's happened too, where, you know, the automotive journalists have heaped some, you know, praise and awards and, you know, everything on a vehicle. And then as the car is launched and, you know, like maybe they make some production changes or maybe, you know, things don't always work out. And you, of course, you don't have an engineer standing by to fix everything that goes wrong with it the moment that it goes wrong. So that happens, and you know, and the people, you know, as people drive them and the people start to become familiar with them, the car is sort of a letdown. And there have been a lot of times in history that that's happened. And I always find that fascinating when, you know, the journalists have to kind of step back and say, like, yeah, we made a mistake on that one, and here's the reason why. You know, this, it was just, again, one of those ringer cars. So I thought that was kind of a funny article to read. And if you can, just do some research on that and find out what that's all about, too. But let's dig right into our list here, and we will start with one that I think very few people – actually, you know what? I'm going to say people have an initial reaction to this one, but then later, if you talk to somebody that actually owns one of these, they're actually quite happy with the car, and it is the Pontiac Aztec. Now, the Pontiac Aztec was built from 2000 to around 2005 in Mexico, and there was a corporate counterpart to that. There was the Buick Rendezvous, which is a lot – very similar, had a different look to it, though. And that's what turns a lot of people off to the Aztec, is the appearance of this thing. It's an ugly car, really. I mean, and that's, again, my opinion, but you're going to hear a lot of that, you know, all throughout the day today. So four-door SUV, it just never really took off. People that did drive them really appreciated them, though. They really liked them. And chances are, if you know somebody that owns one right now, they're probably still happy with it. I mean, from what I hear, if you can get inside one and drive one, you would like it enough to buy it. But that was the thing. It was a hurdle that a lot of people couldn't get over, is the outward appearance of this. I guess you can still get them kind of cheap on eBay if you want to try that. You know, try that avenue to get one, or on Craigslist or wherever. But the thing was, it was a very satisfying car to drive, I guess, in the end, and used in one of my favorite TV series, in Breaking Bad, of course, Walter White's car. I don't know. I thought it was an interesting vehicle for this list anyway. And I can see why it's included in something like this. Again, just a bad looking car, but it's a very functional car. So, you know, can go either way on that one. The next one on the list, the AMC Pacer. Now, the Pacer is another one. This is a second car on the list here that, I don't know, I've never driven a Pacer. I've been around Pacers before. I've had friends that have owned them. I guess friends, families that have owned them. They were parents, you know, at the time when I was much younger. It was built from 1975 to 1979. It's a heavy car. Believe it or not, a Pacer weighs somewhere around 3,000 pounds. So it's a great big heavy car. It has a terrible reputation, but the thing is, it's a kind of a nice little wagon. And it's got a lot of cool little features to it, and it's another one that I guess if you get in it and you drive it, you would actually be happy with it. You know, it was used in Wayne's World in the movie, infamously. Was it Garth, I think, drove one with flames painted on the side and everything. It was kind of a cool version of that. I think it even came back later in another movie, a sequel, even cooler looking. But anyways, it's a cool little car. We should probably talk about the Gremlin, too, at some point, but maybe we'll get to that in another episode. But next one on the list here is, this is one that I don't know if many people will have many good things to say about this one really at all. The Chevy Vega. And the Chevy Vega was built between 1970 and 1977. It was introduced as a 1971 model year car. And the interesting thing about this one, and I know that this character has come up many times in Car Stuff's history, It was created under the reign of John DeLorean. So when John DeLorean worked for Chevrolet, the Vega was one of the vehicles that he was kind of responsible for. He was in charge of that division that created that. And there were a lot of problems with this car. I guess it had a lot of rust issues. It was breaking down all the time. It was supposed to kind of make its inroads, I guess, with the group of people that were starting to transition over to the imports, the smaller imports that were fuel efficient and much more garageable car, I guess, if you want to put it that way, compared to the big cars that we were looking at the time, you know, the 19, 20-foot long boats that were, you know, in everybody's driveway during those times in the early 1970s. It's not a great car. It did have these rust issues. It was just a mechanical nightmare for a lot of people. Other people I've heard that have owned these in the past said, oh, it was a fantastic car. I really like mine, but yeah, you did have to deal with, you know, horrible oil leaks, and you had to deal with, you know, like the car would smoke every time you started it up. just build quality was in general poor. But for the tie-in alone with John DeLorean and maybe you know, some of the history that comes along with that, it's worth looking into if you want to dig into the history of one of these. It's kind of fascinating. One that I think no one will argue on this list is the next one, the Ford Pinto. And the Ford Pinto was built between 1971 and 1980. And there was also a Mercury version of this car. It was called the Bobcat that was built between 1974 and 1980. You could get it in three different models. You could buy you know, the two-door fastback sedan that had a little trunk attached to it. There was also the three-door hatchback and then a two-door station wagon, which, I don't know, little station wagons are kind of cool, so that might have been kind of fun to own. But the problem was this was an unsafe car, and I think we all know exactly what happened with this. You know, I know that Ben and I have talked about this in the past on car stuff as well. We had not a whole show focused on this vehicle, but I do know that during a show that we called the 10 Most Terrifying Manufacturing Defects from 2016, you can go back into our archives on carstuffshow.com and find that show. And we do talk at length about the Ford Pinto and exactly what went wrong there. Of course, there, you know, the safety, this car brings up a lot of issues. You know, it's safety issues, business ethics, you know, a lot of other issues come up when you talk about this, and you know, the internal cost benefit analysis that happened, and you know, why they didn't fix the problem that they knew they had. It did lead to some deaths. You know, you would think that it killed everybody that owned one, but it didn't. It was something around the neighborhood of 27, 28 deaths, I believe, something like that. And those are the ones in the accidents that resulted in fire. There are a lot of injuries, and you know, we'll tell you all about the fix and what they eventually did to correct the problem. But again, go back to that 10 Most Terrifying Manufacturing Defects show from 2016, and you'll find a lot more information about the Ford Pinto. And I don't know about the Bobcat, maybe a little bit about that. We'll see. All right, next one on the list here. I think this one might divide a lot of people. I'm not a big fan of this car myself personally. This is the Chrysler PT Cruiser Convertible. Now, they spelled out the convertible in particular because this one has, well, I'll just put it this way. It has a unique look to it for a convertible. This is a car that was originally supposed to be a Plymouth brand vehicle. But as you know, the Plymouth brand went defunct in 2001. So when this car was being launched in 2000, Daimler Chrysler, who was the parent company at the time, already knew that the Plymouth brand was going to be going away. So they decided to bring that over to the Chrysler lineup of cars. And it was made in Mexico and also in Austria. That's where they were manufactured. It was built between 2000 and 2010. It was supposed to look like, I mean, the whole thing overall is supposed to look like a 1949 Chevy Suburban. That's the car that it's kind of styled after. And I don't know. Some people see it, some people don't. But a lot of people just think it's blocky. It's uncomfortable. It just doesn't look good. It's underpowered. It's just kind of an awkward looking convertible as well. So, gosh, I don't know. There's so much more to cover in this list. You know, and we'll get to it in just a moment after we take a word from our sponsor.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Probiotics aren't a trend anymore. They're a mainstay in the health and wellness aisle of your favorite store. And Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls are the easiest way to introduce a probiotic into your routine. I mean, they're just what they sound like. Adorable little pearls that couldn't be easier to take. But they still pack that probiotic punch. Each tiny pearl has 1 billion active cultures and protect against occasional bloating, constipation, and digestive discomfort. And they actually support both digestive and vaginal health, so that's a win-win. And according to my little fact sheet here, they're designed with a triple layer coating that protects each pearl from stomach acid, so they can make it all the way to your small intestine where they're needed most. You probably didn't think we'd be talking about the small intestine today, did you? Well, digestive health is kind of important. If you know, you know. To learn more about Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls and how they can fit into your routine, visit naturesway.com.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back, and we're going to continue with our list here. I think we just covered the PT Cruiser convertible, and that was what a nightmare that one was. I can tell you another one that was a bit of a nightmare for a lot of people, and that is the Renault Dauphine. Now, the Dauphine is a car that was built between 1956 and 1967, and maybe the sole reason that this one had problems is because of, at the time, French engineering. And French engineering at the time, the French-built cars were not fantastic. Renault's had some issues, some quality control issues at the time. And I don't, you know, honestly, I don't even know how they're doing now. I'm going to have to dig into the Renault story a little more and find out what's going on with them now. And I think they're producing fine automobiles now. But at the time, and again, qualifying that with at the time, French engineering was really, really poor. I had a former boss, the guy that I worked for just before coming here to work, doing this podcast here in Atlanta. And this is a decade ago, maybe more, probably 12 years ago. And he had one that he drove through college. And this guy was big. I mean, when you look at the Dauphine, it's a small car. When I say big, I mean the guy was like, he was proportional, but he was tall. He was like 6'4", 6'5". I don't know how he got himself into and out of that car. But he was constantly lamenting the fact that he owned this car for so long during college, and it was always breaking down, always giving him trouble. That's the only personal experience, and that's only like secondhand. But it was assembled all over the place. I mean, we say that, you know, the engineering is French. It was assembled everywhere, though. It was assembled, in France, Mexico, Spain, Argentina, Australia, New Zealand, Italy, Brazil, Israel, Belgium. It was built in a lot of different places, and I think there are even more than that. That's just a shorter list. But so you can't completely blame it. But I guess it wasn't a quick car either, you know. But it was kind of that mid-50s small car that people really wanted. I guess the acceleration was really, really poor on this thing. in this article, I'll tell you what it says. It says it went from 0 to 60 in 32 seconds. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. It might have. It might have been something like that. But it did say unless it's being pushed off a cliff, at which point it would finally know what acceleration felt like. Ha! Yeah, I like snarky lines like that at the end of some of these lists that are calling out some bad vehicles. Now, this one, the next one on the list, is something that, to be quite honest with you, I'm not sure why it made this list. It's a one of a kind vehicle. It was a prototype car that was built, or a cycle car, really. It's an American cycle car. It's the Scripps Booth by Autogo. And I guess the buy part is because it has two wheels, but this is a really unusual looking vehicle. It's kind of it looks like a motorcycle at the front, but it has a V8 engine and a very narrow car body at the back end, and then again a single wheel. But then it also has these outrigger wheels that come out from the back of it, and that's for stability. You know, when you're in a stoplight or whatever, you can manually put those wheels down. This is such a strange addition to this list. It was built, the company, I should say, Scripps Automobile Company, was only around from 1908 to 1912, so that's the era of vehicle that we're talking about. And there was only one of these built, and the car that was built is now on display at the Detroit Historical Society, which is actually a museum in downtown Detroit, with a lot of other non-automotive related stuff that's going on there. You know, they have stuff from like the fur trapping days. They have just Detroit history stuff. But if you do want to see this one vehicle, that's where you can find it, at the Detroit Historical Society. And just go online for a photo. And actually, this car comes up a lot of times if you search, believe it or not, if you do a Google search for, you know, ugly cars or you know, just the worst cars ever built or something like that, you'll find that you'll see a, not a, but the Scripps Booth by AutoGo. All right, the next on the list is one that we've already talked about here on the new car stuff, the Bricklin SV1. That made the list for one of these best of the worst cars ever made. And I guess after, you know, hearing the history of that whole thing, you probably would understand why this car would be included on the list. I mean, it was an interesting idea. It just never really found its way, I guess. And one thing that, since we've already covered this one pretty much in depth, I don't know if I really need to go into a whole lot of detail on this, but I do want to mention one thing. You know, in that first episode, I talked about how I've only seen one of these in person, and that was at the Auburn Cord Duesenberg Museum. And I was confident that that car was orange in color. Well, I went back to my desk later that day and I looked up the vehicle, and in fact, it was a green car that was on display. Now, it was a Bricklin, of course, but it was green. I don't know why I had orange stuck in my head, maybe because there are so many photos of orange cars online that had stuck out. But I found that it was a car that was on display. It's no longer there. It was on display for a total of about 12 years. I think I saw one place that said it was 14 years, but it was on display for a long, long time. It was loaned to the museum from someone who owned the vehicle, and I guess they wanted it back. They took it back to their collection or for their collection. But again, that car was not orange. I know it's not a huge, you know, discrepancy for me to note here, but I figured I might as well mention it because I felt kind of like a fool when I was so confident that car was that safety orange, but it wasn't. All right, another car here that I think this one, you know what, I'm going to say that this car, for me anyway, does not belong in this list. It's one that I actually like, and I think maybe it's something that I've just kind of grown to like over the years. And, you know, maybe it's, I don't know, a little bit of nostalgia, I guess, looking back at it, if you can call it nostalgia. It's the Plymouth Prowler. And the Plymouth Prowler was built between 1997 and 2002. Now, I know that this is one of those cars that you know, it separates a lot of people. They either love it or hate it, and I don't think anybody's kind of like 50-50 about the Plymouth Prowler. It has that retro styling, kind of a hot rod look or a sportster style, you know, from, I don't know, maybe the 30s or something. I don't remember exactly what car was, or if there was a car that was you know, it was designed after, but an interesting looking vehicle anyway. And now, I mean, if you see one now, and I have recently, I've seen them on the road, I've seen them at dealerships even for sale, not, you know, used car dealers, obviously, not a new car. I think it's a fantastic looking car. The problem was the same problem, or the problem with it even now, is the same problem that people had with it right from the very beginning. If you're going to make a car that looks this cool, that looks this like much like a hot rod, it needs to have a strong engine, a strong V8 engine under the hood. It needs to have, you know, Corvette-like performance. It needs to have something like that. The problem was they just put in kind of a basic Chrysler engine, and it was a 3.5-liter V6 and 250 horsepower. The car had a hard time getting out of its own way. It really did. It was just it was not fast. It wasn't particular, and it wasn't super slow or anything. It just wasn't what you would expect when you see the Prowler. It's a dramatically styled vehicle. You would expect some dramatic performance out of this car. And I know that a lot of people have modified them, have put in V8 engines, have kind of made them their own, and you know, there's some great versions of it out there. If you really want to get one of these, if you want one in your garage because it, you know, it has that kind of cool retro look, and you're not concerned about going super fast, you're not concerned about you know, taking it to the drag strip or anything like that, this is kind of a fun car to own. It's I've driven Prowlers in the past, and I happened to work for Chrysler during the time when they were building this, and we were able to have some of them at the studio that I worked at, and I was able to drive them, and I was happy with it. I thought it was fun because I wasn't, again, trying to race it or anything like that. I wasn't trying to drive super fast or, you know, corner really hard with it. That's what the Vipers were there for. But again, I don't agree with that one being on this list. The next one I want to talk about is this one in particular. They call it one certain model of this vehicle, or one certain generation of this vehicle. And this is the Lincoln Continental Mark IV. And it was built from 1972 to 1976. And so this is the Mark IV, the fourth version of this vehicle. This is a huge car. It's a great big automobile. And really, I think the only reason it's on this list is because it was just kind of an excessive vehicle. It was so, so big. Had a 460 cubic inch engine. That's a 7.5 liter engine, a 3-speed automatic. This thing was 228 inches long, which makes it about 19 feet long. So it's a great big car. Has, you know, the enormous doors on the side. It's a 2-door vehicle. I think if you recall, it had the kind of the false spare tire at the back, you know, that had that look, you know, the wheel as if it's facing the back end of the vehicle in the trunk. As they say, it's a great big, you know, wasteful giant car, and I don't really see it that way. I mean, maybe at the time it was kind of excessive. I think it's kind of a cool car to look at now, and it would be really cool to have one. I think. I mean, outside of, you know, fuel prices and all that would be tough. But I guess it would be a simple car to work on. Of course, you know, it'd be pretty easy to work on the old great big V8 engine. And I guess there's a lot of room under that hood. If you look at the hood of a Lincoln Continental Mark IV, you will see that even you could almost put. It looks like you could put 3 giant V8 engines underneath there, and you'd still have room underneath the hood. It's an enormous car, but kind of a cool addition to the list. I mean, it has to be just because on here just because of the excess. You know, just it's a huge wasteful car. And you know what? Let's continue on with our list in just a minute. And we've got one that's coming up here that is an English car that I think you'll be interested in. And you know, we'll do that right after we take a word from our sponsor.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
You know, everybody has their own wellness routine, their own approach to a healthy lifestyle. A lot of the most successful ones include herbs like ginger root, ashwagandha, and so many others. Nature's Way has been sourcing herbs like those for over 50 years. They understand that nature is the ultimate problem solver, so they're dedicated to providing plant-powered formulas to help people live healthier lives. Their herbs can support your health in so many ways. For instance, ginger root and slippery elm bark have both been used for centuries all over the world. Ginger root has traditionally been used to soothe occasional digestive upset, and slippery elm bark to soothe the GI tract. St. John's wort, holy basil, and ashwagandha can provide mood and stress support, which is something we can all use in our modern life. I mean, these herbs come from all over the world, but Nature's Way knows where the best ones grow. They test for potency in their state-of-the-art lab, and their scientists are experts in all things herbs. What's on the label is what's in your bottle, and what's in your bottle are the best herbs around. To learn more, visit naturesway.com.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right. Which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, we're back, and you're listening to Car Stuff, and I'm your host, Scott Benjamin. And just before the break, we had talked about maybe including an English car on this list. And the one that we were included, I don't think many of you will find this hard to believe, but it's the Reliant Robin. Now, the Reliant Robin has had some funny moments in popular culture recently. In fact, Jeremy Clarkson from Top Gear did a very funny, little skit about the Reliant Robin and how many times it rolled over. It was a funny bit. It was a funny episode. But he was continually rolling this thing over. And the reason that it was rolling over, he's trying to prove the instability of the vehicle. And I think that later it was found out that the car was actually weighted so that it actually tipped over more than it normally would have, you know, just for you know, comedy reasons. But you can read into that and, you know, find out exactly what happened with that whole thing. But it was later discovered that he did that. It was just for good humor. It was fun. But the reason that it was so tipsy, the reason that the Reliant Robin is kind of – well, it's a pretty poor design really. And that's because it's in it's a three-wheel vehicle. We need to say that up front. It's what's called a Delta configuration, which is the three-wheel car configuration where there is one wheel up front, and that's the steering wheel up front. And it just inherently makes the thing want to tip over when you're making a right or left turn. It wants it to, kind of nose over onto its, right or left side. The better configuration for a three-wheel vehicle, as we found out, actually has been known for a long time. I'm not sure why they did it this way. Morgan has done this in the past, you know, going all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century, is the tadpole configuration. And the tadpole configuration is when we have two wheels up front and one in the back. And sometimes, you know, there's even a variation on this. You can have, you know, the two wheels up front steering. You can also have the one wheel out back steering. There's several different versions of that that can happen as well. But again, tadpole configuration is far more stable than the Delta configuration. Now, the Reliant Robin, just so we can kind of get some background on exactly what this is all about, it was a car that was made in the United Kingdom from 1973 to 1981. And then from 1989 to about 2001, it was also made in the UK. It was brought back. It was kind of revamped, I guess. And then it went away again in 2001. And it was manufactured then by a company called B&N Plastics. Now, I guess the reason that it went away, I guess, is it says here's the quote from B&N Plastics. Due to various problems, production of all vehicles was put on hold in October of 2002. I can imagine that's I think we all know what some of the problems were. It's physics. That's the issue there at that car. But the Reliant Robin, actually the one that we're talking about is called the Reliant Robin BN1. And the BN1 actually has a fuel economy of around 80 miles per gallon, which is pretty good. They also, you know, at the time when they closed too, I should mention this, they had plans to make an all-electric Reliant Robin with something like a range of like 50 miles and top speed of around 50 or 55 miles per hour. So, you know, it's funny, they had plans to even bring this, you know, far into the future, but just never realized that was the issue. The next one on our list here, this is also not going to come as a surprise to anybody, the Yugo. Now, we talked about the Yugo in the very first revamped, I guess, episode of Car Stuff when we came back just a few episodes ago talking about the Bricklin SV1, because the person that was responsible for bringing this car to the U.S. in 1985 was Malcolm Bricklin. And believe it or not, this car was made – okay, we know it was made around 1980. It didn't come here until 1985. Started in 1980 in Yugoslavia, of course. It was built all the way until 2008, which I find hard to believe. But, you know, when it did come here to the U.S. and we talked about how popular this car was, it sold 163,000 units in just 3 years, which made it – I think it was like the best-selling or the hottest-selling new car in the American market at the time, or maybe the new hottest-selling new small car. There was some kind of classification that made it that, but might possibly even the best-selling car at the time. It was also the least expensive new car sold in the U.S. at the time, and the price was around $3,990 brand new, and that would get you the Yugo GV, and GV stood for great value. In fact, actually, you know, I bet a lot of people don't know this, but there were it looks like six versions of the Yugo that were sold here in the United States. There was the GV, which was, of course, great value. The GVC, which had a glass sunroof. So these are minor differences between them. So the GVC had a glass sunroof. The GVL, which was nearly identical to the GVC. There was the GVS, which had a few, you know, like minor trim and upholstery upgrades. There was the GVX, which was kind of the sportier version of the Yugo, if you can imagine that. It had a 1300cc engine and a 5-speed manual transmission. And then there was even a convertible version that was sold in 1988, if you remember the Yugo convertible. I don't know if I've ever seen a Yugo convertible, but they're out there somewhere. I'm sure you can find one somewhere. They're a lightweight vehicle, got you know, decent fuel mileage, decent gas mileage. It only weighed something like 1,800 pounds, so it was pretty, you know, pretty lightweight. Got decent gas mileage, of course, built in Yugoslavia, and didn't last very long here in the United States. It wasn't terribly popular after people started to realize just how unreliable these cars were. And speaking of, well, I don't know if I should say unreliable. It's just something that not many people are familiar with, or not really, many people really would want to own here in the United States anyways, at least. This is an East German car. It was built from 1957 to 1991, and that is the Trabant. Now, the Trabant, and I've heard that pronounced a couple different ways. I say Trabant. But it was it's one of the cars from East Germany before, you know, it was before the wall came down, before East Germany, West Germany combined. And we did an episode that I know featured the Trabant back in July of 2013. It was called Cars of the Iron Curtain. And we described exactly how, how miserable it was to get one of these. You know, because you often were on waiting lists. You know, it was a car that was, completely outdated by the time you got it. You were on waiting lists for sometimes many, many years at a time in order to get a new vehicle, and kind of having to make do with whatever you had, you know, at the time. And so this car, again, it was built in East Germany from 1957 to 1990, but it did continue on after Germany was unified, and from 1990 just until 1991. So another, you know, 1 year of production, maybe two if you count model years. But there were something like 3.7 million of these cars produced. So they're out there, just not very prevalent here in the United States, but around the world, yeah, you can find Trabants still hanging out. I don't know how many of them are in great shape or anything like that, or if there's even an owner's club, you know, that's excited about owning the Trabants. I'm sure there are. There's clubs for just about everything. Maybe even the next vehicle on our list, which is the Toyota Previa. Now, the Toyota Previa, I think this is one that's, there's actually three generations. It's made in Japan. It's an old, the first one, I guess, the first generation was a, this is kind of crazy. This is a mid-engine minivan. I know that's kind of hard to believe. It's, for a while, it even had a supercharged gasoline engine. Then it had a turbocharged diesel engine for a while. But it's, again, a front mid-engine, I guess. It's a rear-wheel drive layout. But that mid-engine, of all things in a minivan, makes it kind of like really well balanced. It's kind of from what I hear, it's a fun car to drive. There's the first generation cars which have I don't know. It's a unique look. Let's put it that way. And they were built from 1991 until about 1997. And I think actually the model year maybe is 1991, because I believe they were built in 1990. But these are still being made. They're still being produced in Japan. And also, I think they were being produced in Australia, I believe. Again, if you can get your hands on one of these older versions and make it into a track car maybe of some kind, you might want to give that a shot and see what happens. But that mid-engine thing is kind of funny. Now, they have, of course, switched in the third generation to a front-engine, front-wheel drive, and then a front-engine, four-wheel drive model. So, it seems like... I don't know. It seems like maybe get your hands on one of those first two generations and you're doing all right. The next one, we're getting close to the end here on this list, I promise. But the next one is the Chevy SSR. Now, the Chevy SSR was built in Lansing, Michigan, and this is the General Motors pickup, the Chevrolet pickup, rather, that had kind of that old retro look. It was supposed to look like a 1947, 1955 Chevy pickup truck. It was, of course, inspired by those 40s pickup trucks. It has this retro look with kind of like, you know, all the modern technology underneath. So, or modern for the time anyway. It has the 400 horsepower, 400 pound-foot of torque LS2 V8 that at the time was going inside the base Corvette, you know, back in 2005. So not bad. It was also used in the 2005 to 2006 GTO, that same engine. But they only made this car for just a very few years, or this truck, I should say, for just couple of years, from 2003 until 2006. And, it's got a pretty good fan base. There's a lot of people that really like these. I still see them around town, still see them for sale occasionally around here and there. Price tags are still kind of high on these things. They're not, you still can't find them extremely cheap, but they definitely come down from what they were brand new, and probably worth looking at if you ever see one for sale. All right, I got another one here that is an unusual one. This is really unusual before we get to one that probably more people are familiar with. This one is the Peel Trident. Now, the Peel Trident was a car that was built between 1965 and 1966 only. It was very, very small production, very short production, but it's an extremely small two-seat car. This is a three-wheel car. It was a bubble car, you know, like one of the old micro cars that we've talked about in the past. We even had an episode, I believe, entirely on bubble and micro cars. This was made right after the Peel P50, which was also a micro car. In fact, the Peel P50 was the world's smallest three-wheel car ever produced. It was the smallest micro car ever produced that was actually road-going. It was is an interesting thing. And I think Top Gear did kind of a funny thing with Jeremy. Actually dragging this thing through a building into an elevator or that type of thing. It was designed with no rear gear. There was no reverse gear, rather. And you actually got out and picked it up almost like you would a wheelbarrow and wheeled it into place if you wanted to park it, or you could just kind of carry it along with you, honestly. I mean, you weren't picking the whole thing up, but you were you're picking up one end of it and wheeling it around. It was kind of a strange, strange vehicle. These were made by a company called Peel Engineering Limited, and they started making the Peel Trident in a place called – actually, you know what? I'm reading this here on this in this article. It says that in 2011, Peel Engineering Limited actually restarted manufacturing the Peel Trident in a place called Sutton on – boy, this is a long name. So Sutton in Ashfield near Nottingham, England. Aren't all those names like that in England? It seems like all towns are named like three or four things. Sutton in Ashfield near Nottingham, England. And all the vehicles are hand-built to order, and you can get them in gasoline or electric form, which I think is kind of cool for the revamp of the Peel Trident. But, you know, the original Peel Trident, of course, it had two seats, which I guess already made it different from the Peel P50, which only had one seat. It had two seats, but here's the thing. If you wanted to, you could include a detachable shopping basket, which took the place of the second passenger. So, you know, if you wanted two people, that's fine. If you wanted rather to carry your shopping basket with you, you could bring that along instead of a passenger. You know, it was marketed as a shopping car or a saloon scooter, which I found kind of funny. It's only 73 inches long, which is about 6 feet long, and it's also very, very narrow. It's only 39 inches wide, so that's about a little more than 3 feet. You got to be pretty cozy with whoever your passenger might be. It has a total weight of just 330 pounds, so it's very, very lightweight. And just like the Peel P50, it has a 49cc engine, which means that saloon scooter, the scooter designation is because it's a 49cc. It's under 50 cc's, counts as a moped, but it's a DKW engine, which has only 4.2 horsepower and a top speed of about 28 miles per hour. So that's 45 kilometers per hour if you're counting it that way. And it was advertised that the Trident could get 100 miles per gallon, imperial gallon, which means about 83 miles per gallon U.S. 83 miles per gallon. Can you imagine driving a car right now? They got 83 miles per gallon, which would be really decent. And it says it's almost cheaper than walking. I think that's a pretty funny addition. Anyways, one of the smallest cars in the world. By the way, we should also talk about how low the production numbers on this were. We said that it was built from 1965 to 1966. Only 45 of these things were built. So if you happen to see one, you know, in a museum or, you know, even a collector that owns one somewhere, it's extremely rare, outside of the ones that have been remanufactured in 2011. I'm talking about the original production. Just 45 were built. So it's actually a pretty rare find. If you happen to run across one, maybe you should pick it up. The very last car on our list is – I'm going to take a moment here to just kind of describe this, because – what happened here is they've actually given the very last car on this list, this kind of best of the worst list, they've given the spot to a series of engines that came out in a make of a vehicle. They came out in the Oldsmobile. And in Oldsmobiles, they ran diesel engines for a very short time, from about 1978 to 1985. So while they kind of pick on one vehicle here, the 1979 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme Diesel, it's actually a whole line of Oldsmobile cars that had kind of the same problem. So they all had to deal with these diesel issues. And boy, it was a bad time in the United States for diesel engines, and there's I guess some good reasons for that, or, you know, we just hadn't really developed it, hadn't worked it out quite a bit or quite yet. The problem was that these were, of course, pretty big cars at this time. I mean, they produced three versions of the diesel engine between 1978 and 1985, and they went into several different cars, and approximately 310,000 units, which is about 60% of the total U.S. passenger vehicle sales of diesel market vehicles at the time. So that's a pretty big percentage right there, and that was the peak of sales in about 1981. Now, they powered both front and rear-wheel drive vehicles, and there was a 4.3-liter V6 that was adapted to both transverse and inline front-wheel drive applications. And here's the problem. The success was, in 1981, of course, they went into all these different cars, and they looked at that as a success. The problem was it was really short-lived because the gas prices started to drop after the fuel embargo went away. And, of course, there was also fuel quality issues at the time. And so a lot of, these cars that are using diesel fuel, there's a lot of sources, a lot of producers that are creating diesel fuel that, contain water or other foreign particles. It was bad diesel. There were fuel supply issues all along the way. So that's one thing that they were battling. But here's maybe the biggest thing. And, maybe not. I can't even say the biggest thing, really. But they got this reputation for unreliability and kind of just poor performance, which I'll tell you about in just a minute. And what happened was that at the time, this was the face of diesel in America at the time, and that was the problem, because in North America, the passenger diesel market was hurt for about the next 30 years based on everybody's opinion of the cars from 1978 to 1985 that Oldsmobile put out. So that was one of the major hurdles that people had to overcome 30 years later to kind of get over that and trust diesel again. And then we all know what happened with Volkswagen here and some of the troubles that caused. And it seems like diesel is just – it's been fighting an uphill battle ever since here in the United States. I don't know how long it's going to take for the United States to regain its trust in diesel once again. I know there are other manufacturers that create some fantastic, strong diesel engines, but there have been some real stumbling blocks along the way. Now, one good thing – this is actually a really good thing you know what? I'm gonna hold off on the good thing just for a minute. I want to tell you more about the bad just for a second, and then we'll get into the really good thing. But I mentioned the poor performance. These are pretty big diesel engines at the time. They were V8 and V6 engines, but decent size. The power of these bigger vehicles. The problem was they just didn't have the power to power those big vehicles. So we're looking at engines that had horsepower ratings of something like 85 to 120 horsepower, and we're talking about in a big, heavy, large vehicle. That was tough to get moving, tough to emerge on the highways, tough to pull out into traffic. So this really poor performance was something that really, really hurt them. Now, I said I was going to mention something that was good news about these things, and the one good thing is that these Oldsmobile diesel engines, they had extremely strong blocks. So you'll see that these blocks are still used in vehicles that people have converted over to gasoline-powered engines, in particular, race engines. So they use these old diesel blocks from these Oldsmobiles and convert them to gasoline. And because they're built for extremely high pressure for diesel applications, they're bulletproof. They're very, very strong blocks, and people really seem to kind of gravitate towards those for racing engines. So I think that's a decent thing, a decent legacy for those. But it's too bad that it really harmed Oldsmobile's reputation as well as diesel's reputation for quite a long time after that. And again, I don't know if diesel, I know diesel didn't, but I don't know if Oldsmobile ever completely recovered from that. And as we know, that brand is gone at this time. I don't know if I have a whole lot more to cover on this. I know that, this list, the 17 best bag cars ever built. And again, this comes from The Coolest. That's the site. If you want to go check that one out, it's thecoolest.com. And search for that, those keywords, you'll find it. I know it's not a complete list. It's they never are, right? I mean, it's just a short list that someone threw together. But I think they're fun. They're fun to go through and kind of, pick at your own. I agree with that. I don't agree with that. And I hope I've done that along the way, some at least. And maybe kind of made you think about some other things, some other vehicles along the way that you think are some of the best bad cars ever built for whatever reason. They have redeeming qualities. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're just pure bad. I don't know. Just write in and tell us exactly what you think about this list. And maybe you've seen other lists, or maybe you've got your own list that you'd like to send in and talk about. And, you know, if you want to do that, we're definitely hooked up on the social networks. We've got Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where we are CarStuffHSW at all three of those. And if you want to go to our website and check out our archive of material, where we have, gosh, it seems like it's well over 900 episodes at this point, from the going back all the way to 2008. You can go to carstuffshow.com and check us out there. Thanks again for listening. Car Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander, or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So Toyota is electrified diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.